guest time.
Hello everyone and welcome back to Clandestime. I am Tom Secker, coming to you from the grassy knolls of North Yorkshire. And this is episode 66, Homeland Season 5, episode 12.
I am now convinced that he was a vital member of the terror cell that planned this attack.
What do you want?
Where is she, Yennefer?
Tell me she is in custody.
He's out of surgery. The hematoma was very large.
There are hundreds of people on the platform, thousands in the station. That train will push the gas everywhere.
Okay, well, for the last time this year, I guess, I'm saying welcome back to Clandestime, Pierce, and... going to be talking again about Homeland Season 5 once again, and we're going to be talking about the finale, and I suppose looking back on the whole series itself. But first, welcome, and how are you today?
I'm good. I'm good. I'm again. I'm excited to finish the series, but I'm also a little sad as well that it's over.
So am I. In truth, this has been a fun series of discussions. We've gone a long way into this. We've got into some very, very interesting and diverse areas, to be honest, talking about Homeland this year. But contrary to everything we've actually been saying in recent episodes, Homeland has been renewed for a sixth season.
Yeah.
They just left it very, very late to announce the decision. And I think that was deliberate, you know. I think they did that to add a bit of tension. Because,
yeah,
I mean, like last year, when they had a little break in the schedule, there was an extra week before there was the new episode because of Thanksgiving. And the whole thing just seemed to be designed to give a little bit more suspense and a bit more buzz and all of that. So, yes, we are going to get more Homeland next year. And I guess next year we're going to be reviewing it again in at least some format. But this final episode, obviously... people should go and watch it before listening to the rest of the conversation. But what did you make of it?
It was not quite the season finale that I wanted. Stylistically, this was a vastly different episode from pretty much anything in this entire series. It was a very, very strange pace, very strange ideas going on. And I have to say, I didn't really like this episode that much. It was, you know, they sort of got rid of the action terrorism stuff in like the first 10 minutes. And then it was this sort of strange, meandering tale about Carrie and redemption. And I'm sure we'll get into the spiritual nature of this episode, which I was really didn't understand. But overall... I think it kind of fits in to this season because this season has been kind of all over the place, very much like this finale.
Yeah.
But, no, it wasn't my favorite, but, you know, I enjoyed it enough, I guess.
Yeah. I found it relatively engaging in terms of its pacing and what have you, but yeah, like you, I was wondering what the hell are they even on about half the time in this episode. But just to summarize it, so right at the beginning, Carrie, of course, prevents the sarin gas attack. She kills BB and Kasim in the process, although Kasim had already been shot by BB and was probably going to die anyway. But the sequence ends with Carrie thanking Kasim for saving Quinn's life, and Kasim dies in her arms. She then goes back to Jonas, and they briefly reconcile before he explains that they have no future together and he just can't live a life with a person like her. In our favorite actually storyline in this whole series season, Laura Sutton, or Laura Poitras, is arrested by the BND, and Astrid explains to her about Marwan's suicide in the previous episode, and the BND also find and arrest Newman. And Astrid uses Newman as leverage. She tells Laura that if she doesn't behave herself, if she doesn't do what she's told, that Newman will be deported. He'll be sent back to Turkey to face heavens only knows what horrible fate is implied by that. So Laura gives in. She allows Astrid to effectively recruit her and then goes on TV to denounce Marwan as a terrorist.
Mm-hmm.
After Carrie has been dumped by Jonas, she goes back to the hospital and she finds out that Quinn has had a massive stroke and he's undergoing brain surgery and blames herself somewhat for this. She goes to the chapel and has some sort of what I can only describe as an odd religious experience. Mm-hmm. It's not really clear to me what all that's about. Then several days later, we see Daradal in the hospital. I like that scene. And he gives Carrie a letter that Quinn had written to her to be delivered in the event of his death, effectively. She starts reading it, but she's interrupted by Saul, who tries to get her to rejoin the CIA. He tries to get her to sign up again, and she refuses, of course.
Mm.
She then goes to see Otto During, who proposes to marry her.
Yeah.
In effect. Mm. Or at least that they start some kind of intimate relationship. She doesn't say yes, she doesn't say no. It's all left hanging. And in what was probably the most satisfying part of this whole episode, Allison has been hiding out in a Russian safe house that also appears to be some kind of transit point for underage girls to be sold into prostitution. Just in case the Russians didn't look bad enough
by
this point.
Right.
They've got all these people look like, you know, pedophiles and prostitution traffickers. Saul has convinced Ivan to switch sides, dramatically enough, and he has become a CIA asset, I guess, and reveals to the CIA Allison's exfiltration plan, her escape plan. And this culminates with Allison being smuggled back to Russia in the boot of a car, and there's a CIA ambush, and Allison and the two Russian guards are killed Godfather style, like James Caan in Godfather.
Yeah.
And the episode ends with Carrie going back to the hospital with the intention of carrying out a mercy killing. I'm pretty sure that's what we're supposed to read by that.
Mm-hmm.
And we hear Quinn's voice reading the letter that he wrote to her. And he explains that he wasn't allowed to have a normal life and that there was always something drawing him back to the darkness and that he actually welcomed his death. He was almost looking forward to it in a way. And then as Carrie is standing over his hospital bed, there's another flash of light, like the one in the chapel, which I guess is Quinn dying?
Yeah.
Or possibly not. Anyway, I found the whole ending, at least, pretty miserable.
Yes.
It was otherwise quite an engaging episode, and in some ways quite a provocative, and like you say, just a strange ending to the series. What are your overall thoughts on all of the stuff that happened here?
Well, I guess just, well, for first off, they make a big deal about these season finales, you know, like all television shows, you know, the season finale, that's where everything happens, right? And they made a particularly big deal about this season's finale, again, with, you know, hyping it up by not releasing that they were going to renew it. There were lots of, you know, big promotion things on Showtime. You know, they were, I think they did like replayed the entire this whole season on Sunday, so you could, you know, catch up and then watch the finale. But the thing that I kind of can't stand about the showrunners or the producers is that finales don't matter for the most part in Homeland, really. They mattered a bit in the first three seasons where Brody was there, but nothing from the season finale of last year really had any significance in this season. And I don't think that that season six is really going to, maybe it will. But I almost don't anticipate, because it seems like Brody doesn't exist, Javadi doesn't exist, Haqqani doesn't matter.
Even from this season, it's like Avril Youssef Who cares?
He's yeah, right, exactly, well, exactly.
None of that matters anymore.
Yeah, so, I mean, in a way, I kind of, I like that they sort of do a reset with the seasons because it makes it, it can make it fresh and new. But it's sort of like, you know, they play up all of this stuff with, oh, Quinn and, I don't know, God or something, or, you know, the light and carrying him away and all of this sort of, oh, and she's going to marry Otto. And Otto's probably not going to be in the next season. You know, I mean, so it's sort of like they make such a big deal about it, but then they don't, it's not like any of these characters matter once then, you know, next year. So I was sort of like, I sort of felt like I wasn't that all that invested because I had this sneaking suspicion that none of this is really going to matter. I don't think Laura Sutton is going to appear again. I don't think Newman is going to appear again.
Probably not, no.
You know, I mean, I'm assuming Saul and Dar will probably be in it, but, you know, it doesn't, it was just sort of like, why do I care at this point? Because it doesn't seem like this is really going to matter. And yeah, I guess I assumed that Quinn is dead. I don't think he regained, you know, full brain function. And I don't think that they're going to have, you know, Rupert Friend play a, I don't know, you know, brain damaged man in a, you know, hospital bed for a whole season.
I would not have thought so. No, he could come back as Quinn's long lost twin brother.
Right. Or maybe we'll have like a Quinn Brody hallucination scene or something. I will say again, too, the whole Quinn in love with Carrie. I didn't like that in the last season. I felt like it was tacked on. I really enjoyed them as this sort of platonic love, you know, that they respected each other. And I don't buy that Quinn would ever be attracted to a woman like Carrie. You know, Astrid, yes, but Carrie, no, I don't really, I just seems stupid. And it seems like, and his whole, I guess it never happened between us. It's like, ugh, were you really hoping that it would? But anyway, yeah, I mean, it was just a bizarre episode. And, you know, this series, unlike a lot, if not all of the sort of CIA assisted films and things that we talk about, doesn't really do the occult or spiritual stuff or any of the kind of, you know, black magic that we see in a lot of CIA assisted films and things. And I think there's a reason that Homeland doesn't do it. And that's because it's awful when they try. And this whole, you know, Carrie in the chapel and then that little girl who looks, or, you know, turns around and gives her this like death stare. And then the room fills with white light and it's like 4 days later. I just didn't understand it. I don't know what they were doing. I think the show should stick to terrorism and the thriller sort of espionage type show, because they can do that very well, as evidenced by, you know, by this season. But this whole, I have no idea what they were trying to do there. And it just seemed like that this is not that show that you're doing right now.
Well, this is what I was going to ask you about, was these two different flashes of light, one about halfway through the episode and one right at the end. What on earth are we supposed to make of these? Because when I was watching it, the first time, I've watched the episode a couple of times. The first time I watched it, my live reaction was, what, has Carrie now died? And is the rest of this episode... Is the rest of this episode her, like, death dream? Or has she had some sort of whatever? Has she passed out in the chapel and this is all just some hallucination inside her head? I mean...
Oh, and she starts to hurt herself, too. I forgot about this sort of self-harm.
Yeah. Well, she goes into the chapel and she's kind of staring off, not really knowing how to respond. And then she, I don't know, pinches herself in the hand, sort of twists the flesh in her hand to start making herself cry. And at that point, this, like you say, this little girl sat there with her mother at the front of the chapel, turns around and stares at her, trying to do, you know, kid from The Shining kind of thing.
Yeah.
And that goes on for longer than was ever necessary. Then the kid turns back and then we get this strange flash of light. And it's never explained. It's never resolved. It's never outlined. Like I say, my initial reaction was, what is the rest of this episode? Some sort of dream or whatever. I don't think it was.
No.
From having then watched the rest of the episode. But yeah, I really, really did not understand where they were going with that. Because I get the idea, you know, Carrie's coming to these realizations that, you know, she fucked over Jonas. Right. And that's why he doesn't want to be with her anymore. It's because she's, you know, quite dangerous often to the men that she's close to. And pretty much anyone she's close to, for that matter. Then she goes to the hospital, finds out Quinn is very much at death's door. And she kind of thinks, is this me that did this? Because, of course, they woke him up and he didn't know a damn thing. He couldn't tell them a damn thing.
Yeah,
he was practically dead already.
Mm. But no, I'll tell you, Carrie. Yes, it is your fault. This whole thing is your fault. You know, pretty much everything that's happened to Quinn is your fault in this whole series. You know,
more or less,
that Brody died is your fault. All of this sort of awful stuff. Yeah, it was you, Carrie.
Well, it wasn't a large part of why everyone died in the embassy in the last series. Quite a lot of that was down to Carrie, and because she was, you know, fucking this young kid that was her cousin, whatever he was, nephew of a senior terrorist, Haqqani.
Mm-hmm.
So she is a bit of a walking disaster zone. This so maybe it's good that she turned down Saul's offer to rejoin the CIA. And I love that. He goes, you'll have complete autonomy. You can basically do whatever you want. And I'm thinking, really, Saul? You think that's how to win the war on terror, is to let like the least stable woman in Europe with all the toys that the CIA has got to play with? Really? Mm-hmm. But, yeah, I mean, is there anything you can make of this kind of these religious moments?
I mean, they've hinted at it throughout this whole series. Obviously, we have at the beginning that Carrie has, you know, refound her Catholic roots and, you know, she's receiving communion and whatnot. And then there's that bizarre scene between her and Otto in Otto's chapel. Otto talks about how difficult it is to be a Catholic and all this sort of nonsense. Yeah, it's really difficult being a, you know, billionaire Nazi, you know, pretending to have scruples about the world. So I think I think what they were trying to do was sort of introduce this sort of good versus evil that we haven't seen quite so overtly before. I think, while it was, you know, obviously the whole series is, it is good versus evil. It's, you're either with the CIA or you're against them. But now we have this, you know, this sort of other, this sort of spiritual occult sort of a level. And again, we have that line in Quinn's letter where he talks about, you know, that he let the darkness consume him and that, you know, that's how he lived, was in this dark, you know, shadowy world. And I sort of, again, interpreted that as a more occult sort of, you know, that's what it takes to be a good, you know, if you really want to be a good CIA black ops, you know, operative.
Yeah.
Then you have to basically let your entire world be consumed by hate and darkness and death. And it's only in Quinn's death that he finally, you know, gets any sort of peace. And I assume that's what that white light at the end of the episode meant. But no, I think they're just trying to kind of, again, draw the lines in terms of, it is this sort of struggle of good versus evil, and to a lesser extent, you know, Christian or, you know, Judeo-Christian versus Muslim in a sort of ham-fisted sort of a way. And I think that's being echoed by the sort of level of paranoia and the level of rhetoric that we see around the world right now in the political stream, in terms of, you know, ISIS representing this insane medieval, which it is, but they do play it up like they could do this, though. They could totally, you know, take over and create a caliphate in, you know, throughout the entire world. And that it's this sort of, you know, crusade, for lack of a better word, between them and us. And that, you know, I guess just sort of like the sort of, you know, the bar has been raised in terms of how desperate this fight is. And we even get that with Saul when he's trying to convince Carrie that, you know, this is what we need you. This, you're the only one that can fight these guys and blah, blah, blah. So I think it is, they're sort of playing into this, you know, good versus evil. This is the, you know, this is end times. You know, we need to, you know, yeah, this is what it's all about. But again, I just don't I don't think that this, I don't think the writers or the producers are very, they're not well versed in doing that. And it kind of just comes across as silly, in my opinion. And it seems sort of tacked on, and it seems that what the show is, I think, better at is sort of doing the kind of vaguely nuanced, but obviously it is pro-CIA, that sort of a storyline, as opposed to this, it is the, you know, good Christian crusaders fighting the evil caliphate, which is invaded, you know. And again, of course, it's in Europe, and, you know, there's all the, oh, this is, you know, the... what is it? I forget who it was, but when they got as far as like Vienna in the Muslim conquest.
The Ottomans.
You know, yes, the Ottomans. Exactly. Yeah. You know, so I think it's sort of hearkening to that again as well. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think it's just kind of, I think it's just stupid, to be honest. I don't think it really works very well.
It is stupid, really. There's a lot that's stupid in this episode. And the stupidest thing, or the thing that I found most kind of completely came out of left field and seemed to be something that... It was one of those ideas, on reflection, that you write, then you screw up and throw in the bin, and then you come back to and think, oh, maybe let's get this out of the bin again, because we need to throw in another element to this story. And I'm talking about Otto and his Otto Thuring and his marriage proposal to Carrie. I did not see coming, didn't make any real sense to me. Why has he wasted so much time? Why has he waited this long? It did seem like something that they've just thrown in there for the next season, or just to leave a bit of unresolved whatever in the story for people to chat about. And yeah, I didn't get it. Did not get it at all. What did you make of this?
I guess on reflection, maybe it made a little bit of sense that that's why he was trying to break up her and Jonas. But it seems like, you know, you break up her and Jonas, but then you're going to marry her. And I mean, he proposed it in this way where it was like, me and you will rule the world together, you know? Like,
it was,
You know, it's like, what the fuck is going on? You know, and it's sort of like, Otto, you could literally have any woman you want in the entire world. Why do you want to marry Carrie? And also, what is it about Carrie that, you know, Carrie is many things, but I don't think that she's like a social justice crusader that wants to reshape, I don't know, the world the way the Thuring wants to. And it just seems also like that's not actually what Thuring wants to do. You know, what Thuring wants to do is make money and be, you know, an investment banker or whatever. You know,
to me,
run
he just
his family business.
As a guy who wants to be a big shot.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or at least,
yeah.
Or at least be seen as one anyway.
Yeah.
And that's all that really matters to him.
Right.
You see, he actually comes across quite shallow. Really.
Oh, of course. Yeah. Yeah, I don't think he really cares about any of this stuff that he's doing. It's just a veneer to make himself look like this. He's the most important person in Europe.
Well, and possibly to restore a bit of good reputation to the family name and that kind of thing.
Right.
Obviously, I mean, let's not talk about that any longer because that bit of story is just moronic. but we do have to talk about Laura. which I like this. I really like this ending to the Laura story because
yes, I do too.
Despite being portrayed horribly throughout pretty much this whole season, she is now an intelligence asset. She is now working in the media for an intelligence agency, and thus we have a parallel not just with the real life Laura Poitras, at least as far as me and you think, but also it's a metaphor for Homeland itself.
Yeah.
This whole thing. So I really like this. I thoroughly enjoyed this ending to the Laura storyline. Where did you come from with it?
Oh, I think my favorite scene in the entire series, all five seasons, is that smile on Astrid's face when she's at the studio, TV studio, and you just slowly see her step back into the shadows of the TV cameras as Laura's lying. And I thought that was just the greatest scene. One, because even though, Astrid is a BND operative, I she's still one of my favorite characters. I think she's in a lot of ways a complex character, but also a pretty straightforward character where it's like, she knows that this shit is fucked up, But she's like kind of come to terms with that, you know, and it's sort of like, this is my job. This is like what I do. And she seems to be able to at times separate her personal life from working in intelligence, unlike most of these other characters. Mm-hmm. So I find her to be the most balanced of all of these people. And she very much looks at her work as this is a job. You know, even when people are jumping out of windows and killing themselves, she's just sort of like, you know, she's like, Scheiße, you know, fuck, we're, you know, damn, how are we going to, you know, explain this one? You know, and I don't know. And I like the character of Astrid, but I love too that she finally, you know, I guess Laura Sutton has sort of been Astrid's white whale throughout this whole series. and, you know, she finally gets to get her and, you know, and is able to, well, now I have something on you. And again, this sounds so horrible. But I sort of wanted that to happen. And again, that's the power of Homeland is, you know, having that you identify with these pretty nefarious characters and intelligence, and you want them to succeed at screwing who's supposed to be our hero, you know, the muckraking journalist. But no, just that whole scene, I think, was also just a metaphor for not only Homeland, but this is how the world works. You know, there's always some, you know, shadowy figure smiling in the background of news cameras or television or movie cameras or just media in general. This is really what's going on. And I think it was just also another kind of an FU to Laura Poitras for whatever reason that they, want to pick on who we are pretty confidently, you know, sure of is an asset. I thought that was a great look on Astrid's face, like, yes, I finally got her. That was a sort of vitriolic thing that I didn't quite get with Allison in this episode, but I like that Astrid at least got, you know, she kind of got her white whale.
yeah. She nailed some ass. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, let me ask you then, do you think there's a possibility that within the CIA you have one group of people who are presumably running the likes of Snowden, Poitras, possibly Greenwald, whoever else, but you've also got the people who are working on Homeland? Would they necessarily know? Would the people making Homeland necessarily know that Laura Poitras is ultimately somewhere down the line an asset? If that's true, assuming that is true, but...
Mm.
Or, I mean, because I get the idea, most people within the CIA probably genuinely hate Laura Poitras.
Sure.
And Glenn Greenwald, and probably hate The Intercept.
Yeah.
So perhaps what we're seeing here is not all that, it's not ironic or any form of doublethink or anything. It's actually just the result of maybe some people just don't realize how big the game is and how complex the game is. I don't know. Do you think that's plausible, at least? I mean, I think it's plausible anyway.
Definitely. Yeah. Well, that's the thing. The more and more you start looking at people like Alex Gansa or, what's her name? Leslie Linka Glatter, she's an executive producer and she directed this episode as well. And we can get into her, later. But yeah, I kind of wonder, are they aware? You know, like, did they write, it's easy to think, oh, well, it's a CIA show, so everyone involved is sort of a CIA asset, and they know the game, and that's why they portrayed Laura Poitras in this way. But what if it could be the, you know, the Astrid of the Homeland set, who's, yeah, do it like this, you know? And they just sort of write it, and they're, oh, well, oh, okay, yeah, sure, you know, you're CIA, so yeah, we'll write it like this. Yeah, I don't know. I think for as many people out there that don't buy the Snowden narrative or subscribe to something, you know, that we talk about, there's so many more people that totally buy it. Mm-hmm. And especially if it's some sort of quote unquote authority figure, like an intelligence operative telling you a particular thing, especially if you're so deeply enmeshed in this world, I think you would just buy it no matter what, you know, without questioning. So, yeah, I do wonder the extent to which they're aware of the memes and ideas that they're putting into this own show and how that really reflects a a much larger picture. So yeah, I don't know. But I'm not sure.
No, sure. Well, just picking up on the other little bit of this storyline that they finished off, I guess we're never going to see these two again in Homeland. I didn't like the way that they ended it with Newman. I felt it was all a bit rushed. Like the, I think the whole season, they just didn't exploit this character enough. They didn't exploit the actor enough. I think he's a good actor. I liked watching him on the screen, but they barely gave him any screen time. They barely gave him anything to say.
Right.
I understand he's a cartoon. He's a cardboard cutout. But I just felt they could have done so much more with him. And they have done with some of the other hacker characters we've seen in films, whether CIA assisted or not. And yet he was so simplistic. And yeah, the way they just conveniently wrote him out of the story, I was horribly dissatisfied with that. I always wanted them to do more with him.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So now we find, he has asylum status. What the hell did he do in Turkey? Mm-hmm. Why is the Turkish government going to torture and murder, disappear this hacker?
We never find out.
Yeah.
Even
and yeah, and of course, we're never going to find out because Newman's never going to appear again.
No.
You know, he destroys his cell phone after Laura says goodbye, and that's the end of it. I think he was just a sort of a loose end that they never really worked on. So then they were like, all right, screw it. Let's just get rid of him. Mm-hmm. You know, he's just another real bad Arab.
Well, I suppose, but at the same time, they couldn't just kill him. Killing him at that point seemed far too over the top for what he'd actually done. So maybe that was it as well. They were just caught between a rock and a hard place. They can't kill him off, but they need to get rid of him. So they just came up with this lame, let's show him throwing his phone away and then scurrying off into the shadows.
Yeah.
And that was all they could do, because that's all they could be asked to come up with.
Mm.
But any other storylines from this episode that you want to pick up on here?
I liked the Saul and Yvonne scene.
I did.
You know, that again, that's what Homeland does well, is the sort of spy versus spy. And they do very well this Cold War, resurgence of the Cold War. And I know that Alex Gansa is very influenced by, Tinker Tailor and John Le Carré and all that sort of stuff. And I couldn't help but think that that was sort of the smiley Carla, interrogation or that was sort of an acceptance that, and both of them were, Saul was kind of like, I would like to talk to you again. You know, you're good. And there is that sort of gentleman's game, to espionage and the sort of acceptance of, hey, Yvonne, you're good. You duped everybody. You should be proud of this. You did better than anyone else did. And I'm kind of giving you an out. You can go to Wyoming, you can ski year round, provide us a little info. It'll be a fairly cushy life. No one's, hopefully no one's going to go after you. and we can both get Allison, who's obviously now screwed you, because, there were some scenes there with Yvonne where it's like, you're not getting out of this, and furthermore, I don't know why on earth they would get Allison out and leave, this. One of their, one of Moscow's spy masters to rot in Germany. That makes no sense. Allison has no. I mean, it's also like now you're going to have to bring her back and then convince the Russian public of, all of this. This is, great. She's worth it. Blah, blah, blah. I mean, what's going on? And it's like, why? Why? I don't know. I mean, maybe the Anna Chapman sort of thing, but that made no sense to me. I was like, you're going to let Yvonne suffer and you're going to get Allison out? I mean, it made no sense. But I liked the Saul and Yvonne them. I liked when Yvonne was like, it was me. I'm the one that suggested she tried to seduce you.
Yeah.
And sort of a like.
And that's the point at which he turns. That's the point.
Yeah. And there was something nice. There was something nice there too, where he was just sort of like, I'm sorry, but you were an easy target for me. You had just broken up with your marriage had fallen apart. You're middle aged. And it was sort of a like
attractive younger woman approaches.
Yeah, exactly. Kind of opposite. You know, and that was sort of a nice thing. And again, I liked when Saul was like, I would have, when he thinks that he won't turn, he's like, I would have liked to have talked to you again. You know, and I don't know, maybe that's sort of the romantic view of espionage, where most of the time, you know, it's drugs and murdering and child trafficking and all sorts of horrible things. But that was a nice little moment. And I liked that whole thing. I love that we see this Anders Larsen is his name, but he's, you know, this hacker sellout who works for the BND. Mm-hmm. You know, I like that. He just looks like this greasy nerd, you know, that Astrid is ordering around. you know, so that was sort of interesting. And again, is, you know, Laura's in this, oh, you're a sellout, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, they're all sellouts, honey. You know, I mean, the whole Tor network is all of these quote unquote hackers working for the government. So again, that was another one of those moments of, like with the Astrid in the new studio, it's like they're telling you the truth in a lot of ways. You know, this is how the world really works. You know, a lot of these hackers are really, what's his name? Who was part of the LulzSec group. I can't remember. He's from New York City. But anyway, you know, and he sold out everybody and works for the government.
A lot of people do, like you
said. Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I liked those little things. That was kind of it. I mean, I was like, I did want Allison to live just so, you know, we could get Saul opening up the trunk and seeing her try to explain away what was happening. And I really wanted her to, like, rot in prison. but I guess it's okay. I mean, she was, you know, brutally murdered in a hail of gunfire. It's not, you know, it's okay.
you can live with that, can you?
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, I did just want to see the look on her face, like, oh fuck. and this is just a silly sort of a thing in my mind. They, you know, so she presumably she's still in Germany, right? At the safe house, they tell her it's 2 hours. To the border? Now, do they mean Russia or Belarus? Because I don't see, you know, I mean, the shortest route to Russia would be through Poland into Belarus into Russia. And that was just one of these, like, it's 2 hours for what? Across Poland and Belarus and then you're in Moscow? Seemed a little crazy, but that was just like a silly little...
Yeah, I wasn't sure quite what that line meant either.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that was pretty much it.
Well, okay. I mean, let's broaden it out a bit then, because taking not just this episode, but this whole season, what's been new? What stood out as new? I mean, the two obvious things, and feel free to talk about these, that they've introduced for this new season is hackers and Russia. Neither of which have ever really featured very much previously in Homeland, but this season absolutely central to the plot and the propaganda and the whole thrust of the show. So, yeah, those or what else do you think is new to Homeland for this year?
Well, I think the Russia stuff is probably the most significant, and that might be the one theme that does bleed into the next season. You know, I think, you know, that as we'll talk about in a little bit later, how they write the series, you know, they're going by what's, you know, what people are talking about, particularly in espionage. And I can only imagine that Russia they'll be talking about that next year and the year after, you know, this whole, oh, Russia's back, you know, the Russian bear is trying to take over the world. You know, and only NATO is allowed to do that. Other themes, though, I don't know. I mean, the hacker thing, although I have a feeling that's going to disappear. You know, I think that they've basically cut off all the sort of angles of that. I mean, cybersecurity, you know, it might be like, Russian hackers, or maybe we'll see, I don't know, Chinese. I mean, we haven't really heard of the Chinese in Homeland.
No, that's something they could explore, right? Yeah.
Yeah. But no, the Russia stuff, and I think something that's new is actually pointing to real geopolitical figures, which we've never really seen. So we get Assad being mentioned by name. We get, I think that's new to Homeland in a way, is actually talking about, you know, current events. And, you know, it's not just us. Everyone, even in the mainstream media, has noticed and made in interviews with Alex Gansler or other people involved in the show, like, wow, you know, you guys really, you know, hit the, you know, got it on the nose with some of these events. You know, people were, you know, even average people were like, that's eerily, you know, creepy the way you were predicting. And of course, they're like, oh, yeah, I know, isn't it? It's so funny the way that, you know, the real world just, you know, mimics the show that we filmed months ago.
No, the exact same thing happened with Spooks. You had even mainstream articles talking about Spooks predicting the future. And the makers of the show saying, oh, well, you know, we do try and make it, you know, relevant to current events. And I guess sometimes we just get lucky, don't we? Yeah, right.
Right. I think that's new. I think that's the one of the big takeaways in terms of what's new about this, because obviously the first three seasons are about Brody and Carrie. And to a degree, that was meant to inform our opinions about Bo Bergdahl, who's now, you know, on trial for desertion. And the last season, again, was all about the resurgence of the Taliban, which that took the entire season. And now it's only, you know, and a little bit more, you know, of a year, half a year or whatever. And now suddenly, oh, that is real. You know, the Taliban is resurgent in Afghanistan. I just before we started recording, the United Kingdom is sending in a whole bunch of troops back to Afghanistan because all of these areas that they had, you know, quote unquote, liberated are now under the control of Mullah Mansour or someone else. So whereas this season, and maybe this will be the norm, but this definitely what the theme of this season is very much about predicting or informing your opinion on events as, you know, just before, as they're unfolding. And that's very, I think that's difficult to do in a lot of ways. You just mentioned Spooks. Well, you know, Spooks had to, you know, inform our opinion on 7/7 several years before it actually happened.
Whereas what Homeland is doing is more sophisticated in some ways than that. Yeah.
So I think that's something really interesting. And we can get into that a little bit more. But yeah, I think that's the sort of the new theme that I see in Homeland is, and perhaps that's just sort of the nature of the sort of 24-hour news cycle that, you know, our lives have basically become. There's no way to escape this. They need to be faster. They need to be more clever about how they're doing this because, and I think I'm hoping, and maybe I'm being optimistic, but I think they're also doing this because there is a growing trend among people to not buy just about everything that they hear. And that there are more people, even average people. Again, I mean, they spent a lot of time in this season saying, you know, Assad was responsible for Ghouta, you know, Assad. And there was just recently, I believe it was the CHP party in Turkey, which is like the sort of, I guess, like the liberal leftist party, mainstream party in Turkey. A couple members of parliament within that party, again, bringing up this question of Ghouta and again, providing evidence in a courtroom that it was Turkey that provided this. So, you know, if people won't buy that, I think then, you know, the CIA has to be really fast with getting out this sort of propaganda. And obviously is evident. I mean, but by the fact that they were changing stuff in this series because of Paris. That's pretty extreme. That's a pretty bold statement.
And then admitting, you know, that that's what they did.
Yeah, exactly. And then just sort of like, you know, brushing it aside, like, yeah, of course we did. Oh, whatever.
Well, I mean, we'll get into that in a sec. I mean, I've been trying to put my finger on what is different about this fifth season compared to particularly the last one that we studied in quite a lot of depth as well. And to me, it's it's that they've combined. I mean, they always had this element of hyper-reality, this element of blurring fiction and reality so closely that you can't really tell the difference. But what they've added in this season seems to be, it's like a destabilization effect on all of that. That it's not just confusing you and kind of selling you myths and whatever, predicting future events before they happen. It's also just like an assault on your, I don't know, confidence in your own perceptions of the world. It makes it all seem so much more complicated. And like you said before, the way they pull the rug out from under you so often, your expectations are confounded. The things that they've been hinting at for several episodes don't actually happen. They're constantly doing this to you. They're constantly twisting you and throwing you this way and that, so that by the end, you're not even sure what the hell it is that you're watching. Hence why they could get away with something so ludicrous as these religious moments in a show that is now 5 seasons old, and this is the first time that they've ever really bothered to have any kind of religious dimension. It's almost like they're testing you to see how far can they attack your confidence, your sense of certainty about the world, and still keep you watching. And that's what I think is different, to be honest, about this season, is that they've just gone full balls on the table in that respect. We should stop using that expression, but or maybe we should use it more. Yeah, that's where I'm coming from with it.
I think so. I think maybe too, along the same lines of what you're talking about, perhaps this was sort of their experimental season of, you know, how far can we push this? That might have been the sort of goal that came from on high, you know, is there a way that we, you know, can we confuse people even more or confuse them to the point where they just don't even care? They'll just accept whatever you say, or they won't believe the truth, but they won't believe the lie. So it doesn't really matter. Then it's just, then tune out, you know, what's the name of, you know, Kim and Kanye's baby. That's what's important.
Well, or just to treat the whole thing as a spectacle. It's like, yes. It's like a soap opera that you can get engaged in and be excited about this twist and that twist.
Right.
And I'm not just talking about Homeland here, obviously. I'm talking about real world geopolitics.
Yes.
If you can get people to see that as a soap opera, and so it's all about, oh no, well, this week I think Putin's a bit better. Oh no, this is all about Pol Pot or whoever. It's, if they can get people to that stage, then the whole concept of the world stage is manifested, is a reality by default. And not that we're there yet, or even necessarily that close yet, but Homeland does seem to be an experiment in terms of, well, how far can we push people towards that and still get away with a relatively popular show that lots of people talk about, and therefore has an effect and, you know, has a public dialogue about it. So yeah, that's pretty.
No, I think that's
I can sum up this season, really.
No, yeah, I think especially bringing in the sort of world stage and the sort of the idea of that this is theater and that, you know,
it's all about, you know, booing this guy and cheering this guy. Right?
Yeah, yeah, and or even just on another, you know, just that, you know, it's always, you know, all politics, you know, back to the sort of the Greeks and the Romans and the power of theater, of live theater. And again, combining that with Hollywood and with film and TV and the sort of the way that you can manipulate people, that you can change them, that you can turn, very complex geopolitical struggles into, who's up, who's down, you know, red team, blue team, you know, and that's how you engage people. And that's how you also lull people into this sort of, I don't know, this sort of dull, weird, manipulated consciousness. That's really powerful. I do love, just as someone who's, you know, works in theater, that idea, it really does happen. You know, there's something power. I think we've obviously talked about the power of film and cinema, but there is something powerful about theater and about something that's live, that's happening right in front of you. And that's ultimately what, you know, the world stage it is one giant stage with all these actors and, you know, with the producers and the writers and all the other people behind the scenes. You don't really know who they are, per se, that are manipulating and orchestrating and coming up with new storylines and all these sort of things. But yeah, I think that that's very much what the season has been about, is sort of pushing the envelope in terms of how far we can go with this and how far we can do things. And I mean, I don't know, maybe they went a little bit too far, because as we said, I mean, even, you know, mainstream media is like, how are you coming up with these ideas? or why are you changing things that just happened?
Yeah.
That's a question that I think everyone should be asking of the writers and producers of Alex Gansa, is, you know, why? Why are you adding in a line about Paris? Is that necessary? You know?
Well, and just to maybe hammer the point home, the best line, or my favorite line from this season finale episode, was when Saul says to Ivan, it's whatever he says, I'm good, but I'm not that good. This is a story with so many moving parts, it would have taken weeks to dream up. And I laughed out loud when he said that, because it's like, yep, that's the Homeland writers not only patting themselves on the back, but also telling the audience what it is that they're doing to them.
Mm-hmm.
That the way he says so many moving parts, that's the important thing, that this is all in motion. That at any point in this season, when you thought your allegiances were solid and you thought you knew what was going on and who were the good guys and who were the bad guys, you were wrong.
You had no idea.
An episode or two later, you were given something that gave you a reason to completely reverse that.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I thought that was quite a clever line, to be honest. But at the same time, yeah, it is a little bit of arrogance and self-congratulation on their part.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I did just want to say my favorite moment, actually, since while we're on this bit, my favorite moment in this whole finale was the shot of Dara Dahl asleep in the hospital chair.
Yeah. Oh, well, actually, that's like, something.
When would you have ever seen Dara Dahl asleep?
Yeah, sleeping. Yeah. Oh, I assume that he doesn't sleep. Yeah, exactly. In a coffin, maybe, or something.
Yeah.
That was also, the most tender we've ever seen Dara Dahl get. And we hear this weird story about how he found Quinn at 16 in a foster home and sponsored him, and he was joined the CIA at 16. And of course, in the, Wall Street Journal, the speakeasy blog that me and Tom always read with this intelligence expert, that never happens. We've never, ever in the history of the CIA recruited a child or something like that. And of course, that again reminded me very much of Sibel and her and the Lone Gladio and the characters in that are involved in the CIA. And it's like, yes, that's exactly where they come from. You know, they love children like that. No family, you know, grew up on the streets, is very intelligent, but is also, doesn't hold back. And again, that was one of those moments of, no, that is, they are telling you the truth. That's where a lot of these guys come from.
On that subject, there's a bit in the dialogue between Saul and Ivan where he basically says to Ivan, so you don't have, you know, a wife, kids, you don't have a family.
Yeah.
And it is a little hint back to that old KGB thing of they would try and find orphans or people with no family, with no, you know, immediate society around them, so that those people would become wedded to the institution itself, that all of their familial loyalty and all of those instincts would be directed and attached to the institution. That's how you get ultimate loyalty. And so we have it actually on both sides in this, that they're suggesting, well, that's how the KGB in these days, the SVR, the FSB, whoever, that's how they operate. And then at the end of the episode, we have Dara Dahl basically admitting, well, actually the CIA, or at least the Dara Dahl's secret group, whatever,
right, is,
within the CIA, that's how they operate as well. And yeah, we're actually getting some truth there.
And I like too that Dar actually seemed genuinely upset. He actually genuinely, I don't think Dar at all cares for very many people, if anybody. But he did, I think Quinn did have a sort of a special place in his heart, even if he, you know, plucked him from an orphanage at 16 to turn him into a you know, psychotic killer. I think Dara Dahl genuinely cared about him. I believe he refers to him as Peter, too. He doesn't, I don't think he really ever says Quinn.
No,
so either. Again, there's that, you know, and I think that's something, you know, Quinn doesn't, you know, if you call, you know, only a certain group of people call him Peter, you know, that's sort of, I think also Astrid calls him Peter.
But Carrie never does, does she? She always calls him Quinn, even to his face.
Yeah. So and there was just a nice moment. And I like when Dar was like, he would have hated this, you know, hooked up to tubes and all of this sort of, you know, that's not how he wanted to live. And he's even sort of, you know, his version of Sweet to Carrie, you know, and it's like, you were the beneficiary, you know, I don't know if I'll ever see you again, but here's this note, you know. Then it was sort of I like the Dara Dahl character, as stupid as he can be sometimes. You know, he is the deep state. So it's interesting to see his little moments. But I did like that. Yeah, he's sort of asleep, like watching over Quinn. It's like, oh, man, wow. You know, like Saul didn't really visit Quinn. You know, he was too busy trying to kill Allison and recruit Carrie and
get up to no good once again.
Yeah, you know, it's like Dar was actually there watching him. So, yeah, that was sort of a nice, tender scene. I like that. And again, a little bit of truth there as well.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the final thing we wanted to talk about, I guess, is the question of how this show is produced. And we touched on this back in episode 1 or 2 of this review series, that there is this consultant, the former CIA deputy director, John McGaffin. And this is a guy who was deputy director for operations. He was a very, very senior black operations man. We're not talking about some mid-level analyst on the Congo desk. He is...
he is Dara Dahl.
More or less, yeah. And he's the guy who is primarily... He's their primary consultant, at least, for the show. And we knew there was some kind of meetings that the producers and writers went to in order to gather information and, I don't know, gauge the political temperature and stuff like that before they put pen to paper and actually wrote the show. But recently, Alex Gantzer has been laying it out there. He's been telling us there's some secret or at least private club in Georgetown that they went to for 4 days of meetings, all arranged by John McGaffin. So what the hell's going on there? I mean, we know who they're meeting with in broad terms. It's people from White House, CIA, State Department, the usual suspects. But... Yeah, I was just surprised. I more had in mind like an afternoon panel discussion or something. I didn't think of like scurrying away to some secret gentleman's club to have off the books meetings with for days on end. Took me by surprise a little. How about you?
Oh, certainly, sir. Yeah. I will say that I got there's a really interesting New York Times interview with Alex Gantzer that our friend Don Carl, one of the Homeland hackers, sent to me. Coincidentally, his film that he worked with Karim Kopp and Heba Amin, that's on Laura Poitras's site or you know, division of The Intercept, is also up, and we can link up to that as well. What actually struck me again was that this is like an intense several days. In, of course, it's in Georgetown, and of course, it's in some exclusive club that's unnamed. And it's also like, it's not just X. They say current intelligence officers.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not talking about analysts. We're not talking about people working in Langley. And presumably, we're talking about people that are in the field, that are out there, you know,
I would guess
blowing
so.
Up buildings. Yeah. And like Quinn type people. Also State Department, journalists, very interesting. Again, it's like, who are these journalists, you know? I can only assume these are journalists very cozy with the CIA.
Mm-hmm.
And then another thing that really struck me was White House staffers. So again, you know, they're these people, the toughest job in Washington, you know, they're running the country. But then they're hopping off to a very swanky club in Georgetown to sit down with Alex Gansa and the writers. And also Claire Danes and Mandy Patinkin are in on these meetings as well.
Only so, yeah.
Very odd. And again, it's interesting. We haven't heard Alex Gansa talk about this. And I do wonder how much this has to do with the fact that perhaps in part the Homeland hack, sort of exposing them a little bit. Also just the general I think it's getting harder and harder to keep some of these things secretive. Homeland is so big. People are aware, and it is like, especially with this season, where it's like you're predicting events 24 hours before they happen. How are you getting this? We do meet, and we have these all sorts of people giving us ideas and whatnot. And he says in the New York Times article, he's like, they rarely change lines, but occasionally we do. And he mentions that they did ADR. Additional dialogue replacement on Allison's line about Paris. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you saw this, but Leslie Linka Glatter, who is again an executive producer, she told Variety that she was actually filming the finale during the Paris attacks. So, and this was just something that was interesting to me because I always assumed that they had shot everything and maybe they were editing. But not that they were still, because the Paris attacks happened on November 13th. That's like halfway through the season. Yeah. So they're still filming these things. And I'm not sure what it is, but Alex Gansa in the New York Times article also said that they rewrote a scene in the finale because of Paris. I don't know what scene, because it wasn't like they referenced it. Maybe they cut. I don't know.
I'm guessing they wrote something out.
Yeah, but then what did they write out? What was in the scene that they didn't want to say because of Paris?
No, fair question. Yeah. I dread to think in some ways. I don't know. No, this is absolutely fascinating stuff. Yeah. I mean, I think they started this with the last season, where they were filming it so close to actual broadcast date. So they were filming an episode maybe six, seven, 8 weeks
right
before it would then go out. But they had to be, because you remember in last season, we had that line about James Foley.
Yes.
And that was literally within weeks of it happening. That was actually on the TV. Well, it was within like maybe 3 months of it happening. So it was in, I don't know, a matter of weeks after that they write that into Homeland and then shoot the scene. And then it's a few weeks later that it's actually on the television. So Clearly this is something they're doing deliberately, because they could give themselves much more lead time. They could have written this whole thing by whatever, April, shot the whole thing over the summer, and then just sit back and let the editors get on with it. But clearly not. Clearly they are still working on these episodes right up until they actually broadcast.
Yeah.
And changing things, putting things in, taking things out, in order to, whatever, better hit the headlines that they're trying to hit, better incorporate the memes and be so very on the pulse of real events.
Mm.
If anything, that now seems to be their motivating factor more than anything else, is that they actually want to get so close to reality that even the mainstream media is turning around saying, how are you doing this and why?
Mm.
Well, actually, they're not really saying why. They might be asking the question of how.
Mm-hmm.
But...
oh, no, never why. It's just sort of, well, that's odd.
And you know, cool. And,
yeah, yeah.
What's that about?
And, right. And that should really be something that is, disconcerting to people. People should be wondering, why are you... you're filming this so close to airing that you can, rewrite an entire scene. I mean, that's crazy. You would never think of that in a TV show. That's wild. Especially when it's like, okay, so they filmed the last episode on November 13th, but that doesn't mean that was the last one to edit. I mean, they were probably still editing episodes. I mean, that's, that's really cutting it close. I mean, people should be wondering to themselves, why wouldn't
they give themselves more time?
Yes.
As most shows would.
Yeah. And again, why is this show altering details to fit with real world events to that degree? You know, it's not just a little bit. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I don't want to hammer the point home too much, but that is really should be more disturbing, I think, to people.
Yeah, I think it should be pretty disconcerting to people. And if nothing else, it absolutely proves that when it comes to Homeland, this isn't just entertainment.
No.
Anyone who tells you that about this show hasn't been paying attention, because
exactly.
It has gone so far beyond the normal bounds of what we would call television entertainment that I don't think it really classifies as that anymore. I don't think it is entertainment as such anymore. Mm-hmm. And in fact, this season was less entertaining than the last one, I would say, mm-hmm. and partly because of this fucking obsession they have with being, you know, plucked from the headlines storyline stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So, if anything, it's actually becoming a worse show. Mm. And the fact that it's been renewed for another season suggests Showtime's fine with this.
Yeah, fine. Well, two seasons at least. Alex Gansa said at least till season 7.
Did he really?
Good. Yeah. And I'll say in the Times article and in general, you know, because people are like, I'll keep asking him about, you know, San Bernardino, and that might be the next, you know, we might see that again. You know, we might go back to the it taking place in DC and, you know, terrorists all around us in America. Yeah, exactly. I think that's always the important thing is a lot of people will dismiss this. Oh, it's just entertainment. It's just Hollywood. You know, we've gotten that from other people. Oh, you're making too much of this. Well, then don't meet in Georgetown. You know, film this in advance. You know, you can't say it's just entertainment when they're so concerned. Why are they changing lines about Paris? You know, I mean, that's not entertainment. That's a direct political message and an agenda from what is ostensibly a Hollywood show. But they're going to go in. They're going to spend the time and the money to redo scenes like that just to add in one word.
Mm-hmm.
To rewrite a scene, I mean, that's really crazy. And that's, as you said, totally correct. That's not entertainment. This is going beyond that. Mm. And anyone that just says that is not, they're not paying attention.
Well, on that note, I think we should probably wrap this one up for this time, unless there is, of course, anything else you want to add, Pierce?
No, just that I really enjoy doing this series with you. I know it's been long.
And a bit of a marathon, yeah.
Yeah, definitely a bit of a marathon. I know it's been, you know, we've had some up and down episodes of Homeland. And so it's, you know, we've talked about all sorts of different things, not just analyzing the show. And I think that, you know, a lot of our listeners have really enjoyed it. I know that there's some of you out there. I've gotten several messages saying to, you know, asking me to stop talking about Homeland and do some more interviews and other things. And, rest assured, Tom and I are both gonna, you know, we'll get back into the normal swing of our podcast schedule, but it really has been enjoyable. And I think the listeners and the fans that have really clicked with this have just been fantastic. And I think we've just gotten some really great episodes, and I hope that people will just sort of go back and you know, listen to these again, or if you haven't listened to them, to give it a shot. And you don't really need to watch Homeland, I guess. But I think there's a lot of really great stuff in there. And of course, we got to talk with the Homeland hackers, and it has been a blast doing this. And it's been also just a learning experience on a technical podcasting level of doing a, you know, a weekly show, and especially one that's based on, you know, something that's out in the media. So yeah, it's just been a blast. I've had so much fun. It's also just great preparation for the CIA in Hollywood that we're also working on. So You know, yeah, just I'm great. I'm glad, Tom, that you agreed to this when I mentioned doing it every week, and you were like, "Well, we'll see." But I'm glad that you acquiesced and that we did it, because I think it's been a really fun series to do, and just so much great stuff that we got in there.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. It's been a bit of a slog at times, but ultimately, I'm glad we did this, because it's been unlike any of the other kind of investigative review projects that we've done on different media. Usually we just do one conversation, or at most, you know, maybe a couple. But with this, we really have set ourselves a different kind of challenge and come up with a different sort of show, I think, as a result. So yeah, I'll just echo what you said, that the people who this show's clicked with, it seems to have really clicked with, and you've been a part of this, and you've been sending us some great stuff and some great ideas and links and so on. So thanks everyone for that. And yeah, thank you, Pierce, for suggesting that we do this, and ultimately, I guess, persuading me to do this. Mm. It did take a little bit of persuasion on your part, but yeah, it's been a lot of fun. So that was our conversation on the Season 5 finale of Homeland, so I hope you enjoyed it, and I want to thank all of you who have stuck with Pierce and myself throughout this review series. I should be back next week with a fresh episode of Clandestine that will look back on 2015. It will be a review of 2015 in state-sponsored media. So that should be a lot of fun, a very interesting episode. In the meantime, I'll invite you all to check into my site, spyculture.com, for all of my latest articles, podcasts, document posts, and more. And to remind you to subscribe to my site or subscribe to this show via email, RSS feed, iTunes, Stitcher. And all of those options are at spyculture.com/subscribe. If you would like to support my work, then please consider getting a copy of my book, Secret Spies and 7-7, or a download of The CIA in Hollywood. As always, I am Tom Secker, and you've been listening to Clandestine. So thank you for listening, and until next time, take care.